so many people couldn't make it tonight because of the horrendous weather. So I was going to put it on DMC. So there's that. And maybe I'll just start, if that's cool with people. I was going to do more of like a formal presentation. But if you saw the email, it's going to be an informal presentation. Because I couldn't really figure out how to make slideshows and determine which El Jazeera video to play. So my idea is to actually publish some more shit. A lot of my writing stuff is being edited by friends who said I may as well have just written what I did in crayon. It was so bad. So they're going to help shape it together. And then I'm going to put all the photos that I was able to take and all that other stuff up on my blog in VMC. So you can check that shit out then. So that kind of leaves me as to how the fuck I was going to get this started and how to kind of frame a report back from my travels, which is kind of hard because I just kind of want to puke everything out and then go through the chunks. But it's maybe best to assume that we know what transpired as far as the insurrection in Tunisia and Egypt, and maybe starting from that, what we're able to see vis-a-vis the spectacle we all kind of like read online and different anarchist reports. And then I can maybe give my insights from that knowledge of what I was able to find when I showed up. So what I was able to do, thanks to the G8 in Genoa, I got beat up there, some of you know, and I ended up getting a bunch of money, so I was able to use this money to go over there. So I show up, I see all this shit. It took me a while to actually start talking to people and figuring out what the fuck was happening. But what was apparent was that there was some type of counterpower taking place. I couldn't see it necessarily as a parallel state, because just as obvious was that the state had been totally fucking smashed. When you show up onto the boulevard, what this totalitarian government had done was line this colonial boulevard with all of their larger institutions, the cop shop, the presidential palace, the courthouse, all this shit, all the eggs in one basket right there. And each and every one of them were just fucking torched. There wasn't a window to be had. They're obviously no longer in commission, and there's nobody inside these institutions. You had sporadic clusterings of military out front of a few of these places, I think symbolically trying to show that they were still somehow present, but you couldn't see any political functioning. What you were able to determine quickly was that the political functioning that was happened was definitely coming from the people. The people were able to, if you would, recommunize or to create this new form of life within the debris of the smashed out state. So you had bakeries that were handing out bread to people, not so much in like soup lines, but the people who were persistently staying along these boulevards in this kind of perpetual open assembly were being able to feed themselves, were being able to situate themselves there now for 2-3 weeks. A longer ago, I'm just going to wait for my buddies to come in. Couple chairs up here. But what was everywhere was street vendors. And so I was like, maybe this is the way it always kind of is, you know, downtown East Side, always street vendors, you know, this type of that. But again, apparently came to me as people were explaining that you couldn't be a street vendor in downtown Tunis. You were kind of forced out into the peripherals. You'd have to kind of set up clandestinely, sell what you could, and get the fuck out. And if you remember the guy who lit himself on fire at this kind of like ultimate act of human strike, he was a street vendor. So I remember reading that initially and thinking, you know, could that really spark an insurrection that like was able to destroy this whole nation state? And seeing the mass, the multitude of these street vendors, it was apparent that that was the case. Fortunately, I was able to speak to a couple of these guys. I went through fucking packs and packs of cigarettes, kind of like hoping that people would talk to me for 4 or 5 smokes. And that worked. Another downtown East Side trick. And you could see the, like, just the fucking intensity of these guys, all black leather jackets, all big and fucking tough, a very healthy disregard for the fucking police. And now that there was no police, they had just kind of taken over the entirety of downtown Tunis and were just hawking as they would, doing whatever they would, replacing this kind of state power with a black market or with a new type of
reality, a new kind of revolutionary culture, which was apparent not just in the smashed out fucking windows everywhere, or what they called the revolutionary garbage. So you could see this culture in the spray paint. Like, everywhere was just saturated in spray paint of strikes, general strikes, down at the police, liberty, fuck this, fuck that, everywhere. And there's no way that this type of, you know, aesthetic saturation couldn't have effect on the people who were there. You'd see on every corner people in open assembly, everybody talking, everybody discussing, not so much what was going to happen here on in, but kind of celebrating what had already happened. Like, I'd go past the cop shop, which, just a massive building, totally torched to the ground, and everybody who was passing it would kind of like look up at it and kind of laugh, and you could see they're telling the stories like, remember when I fucking smashed out that window, remember smashed out that window, and everybody was just like jubilant and euphoric. So there was also, while I was there, a couple plant, and I'm speaking Tunis, I'm soon going to leave Tunis and see kind of like the larger situation. There were having protests on a kind of very formatted schedule. There was new political parties that had come into existence and were trying to impose themselves on what they considered to be this temporary political void. They'd be able to create their own kind of political institution and join this new kind of parliamentary spectacle that was being set up by kind of this imperial intervention, millions of dollars, Canada donating like $20 million in counterinsurgency, not through military aid necessarily, but in this attempt to build, they say rebuild, but you know, these things didn't exist, to rebuild these civil societies or these democratic institutions. So in this totalitarian society, it was clear that these institutions that people could participate didn't really exist. So their absence wasn't really noticed because these people hadn't really been able to participate in the same kind of democratic hypocrisy that we're able to do now. So there is this immediate reaction of creating new forms of political unity. And where these new forms of political unity were at their most intense was definitely amongst the street vendors and the sex trade workers. I shouldn't say those are the two most extreme, but those were the two sites that I went and checked out day after day. The street vendors, after the initial uprising, went to the train station, which is kind of the largest plaza in the city, and burnt it to the fucking ground and took over the entirety of the out front and created this mass market, which was also an open assembly. There's always these discussions, these interventions of people, just hypothesis and action, where to go forward, what to do now, how to solidify the ground that have gained, or how to dispense our forces so as not to be captured by the reification of the state that was imposing itself through these newly established democratic institutions. So having spent some time there, and I'll get back to it because I did a trip and came back, I was able to go to the red light district, which was in the Casbah. So the Casbah, if you've seen Battle of Algiers, that kind of shit just reproduces itself everywhere. It's a very ancient style of central community, winding streets, very easily barricaded, and a labyrinth if you're ever in a riot within one of those places, which I ended up being in one later on. So this red light district was situated kind of in the central of this Casbah. It has been there for about 30 years, wasn't state sanctioned, but just kind of allowed to take place. And so through the revolution, they're there, no doubt participating in the central center of the city. But now they've gone back to work, the women have, and there's been these waves of protests by these Islamo-chauvinists, or Islamo-fascists, as I came to consider them. They're showing up at the red light districts and attacking it, invading it, saying, you know, no prostitution in a Muslim country, all this shit. But each time they showed up, the women would have to beat them back. So talking to a few people, they'd say how they'd come in, and in this red light district, there's all the apartments or dwellings above, where they just like whip down rocks, TVs, all their furniture, and beat these fucking Islamists out of the red light district. And for the first time in 50 years, they started establishing barricades. They started creating more of a barracks of this zone so as to defend this new kind of autonomous reality that they were going to pursue, still as sex trade workers, but with the power now to determine that that is what they wanted to be. That's how they wanted to make their money. And it was It was fascinating in that how easily they were able to repel these massive forces of society, this raising Islamicism that was encroaching upon the revolution. They seemed to display the most kind of precise tactic of dealing with these fuckers, and that's just bashing in their heads, while at the same time holding your territory and defending it through, you know, violent means, as well as, like I said, these barricades and shit like that. In contrast to the vendors, which were very much a force of dispersal. Friend walking by, Brooke, I guess we're not good enough for her. So they'd taken over the kind of like the central train station, but they were moving themselves out. They were establishing themselves here, there, there, and here. And you could see that obviously there must be some type of network that existed amongst them, if not just by the prices of commodity, but also kind of securing themselves. Because what had started happening was I guess it was the anti-terror police, because the military is kind of more or less neutral in the sense of policing or institutionalizing the crisis. The police don't exist. Like, there's never one cop that you would see because they've been ran off, killed, beaten, whatever. They're just fucking gone as a phenomenon in and of themselves. So you had these, like, fucking super military balaclava, hard, fucking intense hardware that they're bringing out to deal with these vendors, which usually would probably just take a baton or a ticketing to disperse them. But now these people were defending themselves to the extent that they'd have to bring in these more, not paramilitary, but special military forces to deal with them. And I guess I'll kind of like fast forward to after I did a tour, I came back, and I didn't know it at the time, but fucking Hillary Clinton had showed up into Tunis. And so I kind of came into town and I saw like a lot of these military forces that were usually just sitting around smoking in this kind of like inertia of civil war, but actively kind of like prowling the streets, clustering up in certain boulevards and busting individual street vendors. But on the peripheral of the central street vending was like these kind of like old lumpen peasants, people who had been coming from the countryside and were like selling combs and toothbrushes and just kind of like knickknacks for survival. So these military fuckers were going around like bashing their tables, acting very tough, but you could see that they're obviously preparing themselves for something much more intense, that they were going to move in on the central location of the street vendors. So noticing that, I was able to dart through the kasbah and make it to that area before the paramilitary could show up. And when they did show up, it was pretty cool because the street vendors just kind of stood their ground. And when these fuckers showed up, it was like they showed up in their armored personnel carriers. They showed up in, there's a couple tanks positioned here and there. Their tanks weren't rolling in, but their tanks were positioned. They're coming in with their heavy artillery. And the vendors just kind of stood their ground at first until they were able to realize that they were outnumbered, that they were outforced. And before the first tear gas canister could hit the ground, they immediately set all their tables up as barricades, started arming themselves with their like combs and toothbrushes, whatever the fuck they were selling, a lot of cigarettes, and were engaging with the police until it was obvious that the police were just going to fucking open fire. So this mob, as opposed to just kind of like dispersing blindly, kind of reasserted itself within the kasbah, setting up barricades, fighting off the police, holding them at times, but kept moving, but moving in unison as opposed to this kind of like panic that you see at most summits. And they're communicating amongst themselves. There was a communication definitely of destruction along the way where they're pinpointing, or if they weren't pinpointing, they're obviously conscious of these targets as they're moving along, what windows to smash and what windows not to smash, stopping to do the spray painting, all of this type of stuff, moving through the kasbah with me as well, just kind of like scared out of my fucking mind, but also very exhilarated because of the power of these fucking people. Hasn't been in a few riots of panic and terror. You don't really get that, you know, hold your ground and then move back, hold your ground and move back, which is definitely the situation here. So after being able to maneuver themselves through the kasbah, they reasserted themselves on this boulevard and opened up a massive open assembly where finally hundreds and hundreds of people who had heard about the situation, or as I know now, people might have already been massed there because of this Hillary Clinton shit. They might have been having a protest or something. But there's just this massive union of these kind of like lumpen precarious vendors and the more kind of politically conscious leftist insurgents who had just fought this revolution, but people meeting individually, people meeting in these mass groups. A very open and abundant plural belligerism that was allowed to happen so that these discussions could take place in their intensity. You didn't ever see anybody like censoring anybody or quieting anybody, but they would just fucking go nuts on one another, like at times coming to blows, but always the communication would continue and continue. A few of the features which I think distinguish what was happening in this revolutionary period as opposed to when we try to mimic these type of assemblies was very kind of subtle things like women being moved into the center of discussion, not tokenistically, but so that their voices could be heard amongst these guys yelling and screaming. Again, the notion that people could say extreme reactionary shit, but still be allowed to stand their ground if they're willing to hold it. Amazingly, to see the boulevard, and I was able to sneak a few photos, was, you know, that this is an open assembly of at least a thousand, thousands of people, but people were kind of breaking off into clusters of discussion. So you wouldn't have to sit there and listen to the same old fucking thing happening. You could just maneuver over to the next one, maneuver over to the next one. I couldn't understand hardly what the fuck they were saying because it was in Arabic, but I imagine that each discussion was different. I don't think there was like a simulation throughout the whole assembly or anybody kind of maintaining this party line one after another. You never got that sense that there was a party line that was being imposed in Tunisia. In Egypt, it was different, but I'll get to that. So after spending a bit of time in Tunis, I took a series of luges, which is vans, like family vans. I've heard them called resmobiles. Just these family vans that are just packed with fucking people, and you just like drive around in terrifying conditions. And so I took about 20 of these town to town to town to town, doing a couple pilgrimages to known sites, or sites that I knew from the reportage of the insurrection. So by traveling through these cities, one of the amazing things, for me anyways, was to see at the front of these villages or even small towns was where the sign declaring the name of the town or whatever had been spray painted over one after another with the commune. Hammers and sickles, commune, just kind of imposing itself everywhere. I didn't get to stop at all of them, but I was able to, after these couple places, go into a couple of these communes. Before making it into the central interior where these communes were operating as a federation, I went to a prison town. There's two towns close by that, if you're following the reportage, were mass breakouts. One unfortunately led to the slaughter of many of the inmates, whereas the other prison, they were able to overpower the guards and took over the warden's office and opened the gates, and over 1,000 of the prisoners liberated themselves. So I went to that town and I went to that prison. So maybe not the best idea in retrospect, because I should have known obviously what was going to happen when I showed up to this fucking prison, was that the anti-terrorist police just like came right out away, like, what the fuck are you doing here, man? Like, there's no way that you can come to this prison and expect to be let in. I even thought, I was like, oh yeah, I'm from a Vancouver media co-op. Maybe you've heard of us, subsidiary of CNN. Like, and they're like, no, you're a fucking idiot. Like, you know, being pretty brutal with me, hurting my feelings, letting me know that I'm stupid, that there's no way I could get into this prison, and now that they've got me, I've got to come with them into the prison. So that's great, an escorted tour through this fucking prison. So these fucking bonehead fascists lead me right into the prison. I've got to go into a couple of their offices. Each and every one of the bureaucracies that are functioning in this prison takes my passports, does this and that, but I was able to tour this gutted, empty, self-liberated prison. And it was fucking amazing. Like, except, you know, I would keep in mind, you got to be cautious, that people sacrifice their lives so that everybody else could get out. But you would see, like, the courtyard was just mounds of burnt-out mattresses, just revolutionary garbage sprayed everywhere, and all of these fucking screws just sitting there guarding themselves. Like, nobody's there, but they maintain this symbolic image that they're still in fucking power. even though everybody has exited these sites of fucking repression, they're still fucking there, make-believing, and, like, each doing their, like, most dutiful job going through my fucking passport and telling me again how fucking stupid I am and da-da-da-da-da. So they even gave me a free ride back, and it was kind of...
Really speaking English?
Yeah. A lot of English over there. So these fucking cops were really into speaking in English to me, to the point that the one fucking bonehead, when they drove me back to my shitty room, he's like, they let me out, and they're kind of like, see, now you're safe, it's all good. So you think maybe you can friend me on Facebook? So I was like, hey, man, these fucking people on fucking Facebook, man. I sent Gordon an email about that, and he reminded me that all cops are bastards. And that was pretty significant that he said that, because all over fucking Tunis, or I thought at first it was a coincidence, and then I thought maybe it was just in Tunis, but all over everywhere, spray painted, I saw it no less than 100 times, and in Egypt, ACAB. All cops are bastards. So I know, the first time I'm like, no, coincidence, but it was at a high school, right? So I'm like, you know, maybe, because it's a high school, but I just kept seeing it everywhere. It was fucking awesome. A lot of times the A was anarchist and all that shit. So, yeah, all cops are bastards. Don't friend them on Facebook. So I was able to duck out of that, which is surprising, because usually on my trips, I'm, like, really brutalized or robbed or, you know, left for dead. So I thought that maybe this had come to a quick conclusion. I was able to get out. And then that's when I kind of ventured further into the interior, where there was these well-articulated federations, this is their terms, of communes. And if you were to look this stuff up online, or if you've been following the reportage, there's the town Kasserine. They say that this... was the center of the revolution. This is where the most intense fighting had happened. This is where quite rapidly they were able to expel enemy forces and establish their own kind of communal lifestyles, as well as a communal system of control, taking over the municipal kind of powers, making sure that water continued to run, electricity, all this stuff, whilst at the same time expelling legions of provocateurs and maintaining a struggle against the military and freeing all of the prisons that surrounded this area. So I showed up to this place kind of knowing that that this was happening, and conscious of who I wanted to speak with, which was definitely the youth of these areas. So fortunately, I was able to make a handful of tape-recorded interviews with people. So when I showed up to Kasserine, what turned out to be more like a network of villages, Kasserine was kind of the central one, which I couldn't actually get into. When I showed up, there was a barricade set up by the communards, who advised that I not come in at that time because they were expelling all of these fascists, all these provocateurs. So they were going house to house, store to store, stall to stall, and anybody who couldn't be spoken for by somebody else within the community was probably not going to meet a good end. So I kind of took this guy's warning. He was very sympathetic with my desire to get in, but it was just like, dude, we can't protect you. This is like a bad situation right now. But all these other federated communes are more or less the same situation. So the interview that I've got and that I was going to play was on the peripheral of Kasserine. When the rupture took place, all of these people just kind of came together as the state centralized itself in these institutions that were actually outside Kasserine. So the interview with these young insurgents, these guys, it's three guys, two of them are in the last year of high school, one of them is in university. So they were able to find me as soon as I kind of showed up. They ran up and they're like, you know, what the fuck are you doing here? Which was usually people's response to seeing me there. And then I just kind of jabber on about the revolution, and they'd be pretty into that. And these guys kind of gave a better performance for an interview. Unfortunately, a lot of my taped interviews, I would have these awesome conversations with these people discussing the hypothesis of insurrection, all this type of stuff. They're telling me about, like, the extreme violence of the insurrection, their engagement with this violence, all this type of stuff. But when it came to finally putting them on tape, if it was security culture or just that they thought they were going to be part of, like, media, they'd usually kind of, like, clamp down on their enthusiasm. But I thought this interview stuck out amongst the rest for their kind of insurgent enthusiasm. So he ended there saying, they do as we say, or he runs to Saudi Arabia, like Ben Ali. That was the last bit. Which was generally the notion that people had, was that having bled and sacrificed and killed for this chance to finally elect their new masters or participate in some type of popular democracy, if these institutions didn't respect their influence in redrafting the Constitution or all these other things that they were talking about, there would just be another revolution. And that kind of notion of counterpower was the only real dominant or influential power that was there. Like I was saying, and they were saying, there's no cops anywhere. The state institutions that did exist are just rubble. Nobody's really operating except for what was being brought in, except for this type of imperial intervention where Canada, America, EU is coming in with millions, in Canada's case, or you know, millions and millions in the EU and America, with all this money in reestablishing or creating out of the rubble this type of apparatus of parliamentary democracy, which has never really existed there. And that's where I kind of got the notion of what is empire? I've been kind of wrestling with this idea, not in a kind of postmodern way, but in these new type of states of emergencies which erupt from these type of revolutionary ruptures, how are they able to reconfigure their control over this kind of multitude of ungovernability? Because these people aren't going to be brought into this, that, or the other thing except for the promise of democratic institutionalization. So I was wrestling with this idea, thinking that the state had been entirely smashed, seeing that the apparatus of power as we understand it here, this kind of network of institutions that we get kind of sucked into, seeing as that doesn't exist there because they're still relying on these sole institutions, which are gone, where was this going to go forward? And a lot of people, like expressed there, are just saying, well, we're just going to have to wait it out 5 months. Until that time, we're going to totally operate on our own. We're going to have this revolution of our everyday lives. We're going to move forward in this kind of like constant insurrection where if anybody tries to re-implement any type of control over us, we're just going to set them on fire or kill them or, you know, burn down anything that they try to hide in. So I was pretty jubilant about this, seeing that, you know, our side was finally winning for a change, and made my way back into Tunis, where I already told you about that kind of riot that happened there that I was in. Along this way, I thought I was going to get into Egypt through Libya, which at this time was like not going to happen. When I was by that prison colony, that was right against the border of Libya, and there was hundreds of thousands of war refugees coming through. It was a state of emergency that had been, or that crisis had been institutionalized by the UN and other international bodies that had gone and like set up these aid relief stations and all that type of shit. So I wasn't going to make it through that way or attempt. So I ended up flying from Tunis to Cairo after this riot. So there's the riot. The next day I had to fly. And it was a pretty fucked up plane ride because once I got onto the plane or, you know, kind of going through these procedures to get on the plane, which usually they just kind of let you on, it became apparent that everybody but me was a Libyan rebel that was being moved from this front of the war over to Egypt where they're going to be moved in through the Western Front. So I was kind of sitting on the plane kind of realizing everybody was about the same age and had the same kind of gruff about them. And once the airplane doors kind of like closed and locked, everybody pulled out their Libyan rebel flags and started like yelling and singing like, oh, la, 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 like freaking the fuck out. And I'm just kind of sitting there like, holy fuck, talking to these guys. And they're like, why are you here? I'm like, I'm here for the revolution, man. And they're like, fuck yeah, like, cool. We're not going to be war refugees. We're going to go back and fight, kind of like maintaining this resolve. At this time, the NATO hadn't intervened. They were still talking about it, but it seemed apparent that some money was coming in because all these guys are just being flown plane load after plane load after plane load over to the Western Front. So that was an exciting plane ride where I got to talk to a bunch of Libyans who told me by no means should I even attempt to get in, I'd be killed. And so I finally make my way into Cairo. And it's like 4 o'clock in the morning or some shit like that. So I just get in the cab and I'm like, Tahrir Square, take me to Tahrir Square. And they're like, ha, 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 really? Yep, take me. And as it turns out, the following day, the day after the family was spent in Tahrir Square, was to be the referendum. I don't know if people heard about the referendum that happened there. It was a more or less a coup by the military, where they spent what remaining money that they had, and you know, a lot of money else that came in, and said, okay, we're going to impose this democratic, kept using that term, democratic, what you fought for, referendum, where if you vote yes to the ceasing of civil war so that we don't spiral into the situation like Libya, we're going to redraft the Constitution and have an election within a couple of months. So with this as the political context that I show up in Tahrir Square, I get there and already amassing are people who are opposed to this referendum, who are saying that this is an attempt to capture the revolution, that this is a way to reify the insurrection, this is a way to codify it, to channel it into this parliamentary democracy, which is totally controlled by the military and is a total fucking sham. Also at the same time, are new political parties that have kind of risen out of this insurrection and wish to impose themselves on this process, but desire for the elections to be a few months later so that they have more time to solidify and create their own bureaucracy. But standing out very blatantly from these people were the fucking young rebels who were saying, like, no fucking way, we're going to reoccupy Tahrir Square in opposition to this referendum. So that's what I walked into.
Tahrir Square, is that in Tunis?
No, sorry, this now is in Cairo, in Egypt. So I should be more clear. Thanks for being clear enough with me and not understanding. But Tahrir Square was, it's kind of like the biggest plaza in Cairo, and that's where for the 2 weeks of the initial rupture, where hundreds of thousands of people kind of came together, formed this like massive, massive armed commune, fought off provocateurs, fought off fascists, fought off the police. A lot of people were killed there, but always held their ground. And throughout the weeks of the initial rupture, this was also where people were amassing, people were drifting in and out, going to work, but coming back and maintaining this kind of central location of this counter power was in Tahrir Square. So more or less, it was like, in my sense, in the terminology that I choose to use, it was a very, it was a communal war machine. It was this massive commune that was able to feed itself, that was able to arm itself, that was able to defend itself. There was a few phenomenons that stuck out, like the lost and found part of it, where people were returning wallets, cell phones, like money, all this type of stuff. There's been a lot of interviews that have come out where women were saying this was the first time in their lives they felt safe around men, that they could do whatever the fuck that they wanted, that there was a very jubilant sense of defeating the government, becoming ungovernable, but also creating something new. So it was both a commune, a community in motion, but also this hypothesis of where they wanted to go and how they could create this reality in the center of Cairo while being totally engulfed by the military, the police, and fascists who would sporadically invade on horseback and camels. They would climb up the buildings and shoot snipers, throwing rocks. Very violent place, but also very well defended, and they held their ground. Even up to the point after the president resigned, hands over all the power to the military, people remained in Tahrir Square against the wishes, obviously, of the military, who thought by making this kind of symbolic move that this would disperse the crowd. But if anything, it dispersed in the revolutionary motion, these people back into their neighborhoods where they reconstituted or recommunized their communities, which were very much similar to these new realities that had been created in Tahrir Square. And later I go to investigate these neighborhoods and I can talk a little bit more about that. But, so I show up into Tahrir Square. It's crazy, man. I gotta drink a little bit more to talk about it. I show up. I kind of get the sense that something big's gonna happen, but I'm worried that there's not very many fucking people there. And after like 6 years of activism in the downtown east side, you kind of like get that gut-wrenching feeling that you're so familiar with when there's like six of you and maybe five more people are gonna show up and you're gonna head off and do something fucking stupid. So I'm sitting there hoping that this isn't just the eternal reoccurrence of my life. And gradually more and more people are showing up, you know, a couple hundred, a few hundred now. The chants are going. This youth, this mob of youth, all done up, the masks, the Black Bloc, the equivalent of the Black Bloc, kind of shows up. I'm relieved. They're leading the demonstration now, which is still on the side of Tahrir Square. The Mothers of the Martyrs are moved in. They begin their chants. I have a guy who's repeating the chants for me in English. I've got my book here, and it's things like, make your decision from Tahrir Square. Your no vote will cover the blood of my child. All these very revolutionary things. More revolutionary than that, but very, there was a pathos involved, but there's also this very brutal militancy that was like kind of over our dead bodies, are you going to capture our revolution? So this sense is kind of growing and growing, and as the better things happen, it happens spontaneously, that the kind of barricades that are keeping us off of Tahrir Square are just kind of kicked over, and people start flooding out onto the streets. Right away, it was the first and only time that I ever saw a fucking pig in Cairo. These pigs come out, who I'm thinking they're probably just there on their own, and grab a couple of these guys, I'm not going to call them Black Bloc, but these rowdies, grab these rowdy guys and just start fucking running with them. I imagine there's a truck or something over there. So I kind of thought the whole mob was with us, but there's only like 50 of us or something. I'm just sticking close to the guys in black leather jackets and super powerful, awesome women. And they just start running after the cops, and so we kind of move with them, and quite rapidly, the cops are just totally engulfed by this mob who de-arrest these two guys by just fucking killing these cops, like just destroying them. What was left of the cobblestones, there wasn't very many cobblestones left, but these guys fucking found them and were just like caving in the fucking heads of the cops. People had sticks and were just like rallying on them, like old guys, young guys, everybody's just trying to get a fucking kick in. And they're like, whoa, this is cool. And these guys are like taken out pretty quickly, and they kind of get up like nonchalantly, like, yeah, totally, and just kind of like stroll back. And I turn around. Everybody who is surrounding Tahrir Square on the sidewalk has now moved out with this initial rush that chased after these young guys to de-arrest them. So this was able to move the thousands, which soon became thousands of people, into the reoccupation of Tahrir Square. Whereas without that de-arrest, I think people probably would have been pretty hesitant to move out, because the military was there, the military was trying to stand strong, but they were immediately overwhelmed. One of the tactics that people used to neutralize the military's attempts at dividing up the people who were filling the square was they had these huge fucking tarps that they'd walk over to the line of military, put the tarps over their heads, and just start shaking it like fucking nuts. It's like, aah! And the military is just like standing there totally like wrapped in these tarps, like couldn't see, couldn't do anything, kind of like cowering what's happening. It's really fucking loud. Kids are like darting in and out of them. Everybody's like making fun of them. Just like totally dehumanized, if they needed any more dehumanization, but just ridiculed these fucking military goons until they just kind of like slunkered off. So that was the reoccupation of Tahrir Square. It turns out there's been a series of reoccupations. There was one a few days ago where people were just fucking fed up with the way that this interim government was going, and they just decided spontaneously to reoccupy it. And when these type of things happen, more and more people show up and just kind of cluster together. But in this case, a few days ago, the military came in and just attacked, which is maybe the first time that the military has invaded the people on a large scale since the initial rupture. But this day before the referendum, there's obviously a very clear and distinctive stand made by the insurgents that they're not going to allow themselves to be co-opted. But these people are also talking about how they're going to go out and propagate amongst the larger masses their ideas of where to go forward without a referendum, how to move forward without compromising the revolutionary spirit into a ballot. So the next day, these people who I was able to talk to, they were going neighborhood to neighborhood to these polling stations, which most of the polling stations were in the middle class districts. It became quite clear by the way that the military was functioning that this referendum was the last kind of weapon that the middle class had. If they weren't going to come out and try to combat the multitude in the streets, they were going to try to outvote them. So the referendum taking place, it was just the mobs and mobs of the middle class just like rushing to cast their ballots against the insurrection. The military was then like moving around in the neighborhoods, acting quite intimidating. All of their jeeps and armored personnel carriers were like saturated in the propaganda of voting yes for the referendum, all this type of shit. But I was able to go to four different neighborhoods. I couldn't think of anything better to do than go like north, east, west, and south, and went to these neighborhoods that had been reoccupied after Tahrir Square by the people there. And this wasn't a notion that I had. People were quite distinctive about these new communities in motion. They would paint their trees and their poles distinctive colors so that they could tell one kind of network apart from the other. And these colors represented no government, no police. And it was everywhere. So there's also like banners hanging, this and that. People kind of like adamantly out in these open assemblies, everybody out in the coffee shops. But what was kind of most reassuring neighborhood to neighborhood wasn't so much people agitating no for the referendum, but they just couldn't give a fuck about the referendum at all. They would repeat the same kind of notion that those younger insurgents had, that like, well, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. If that shit imposes itself on us again, we'll just have another revolution. So if they want to play at democracy, that's their own shit. These neighborhoods, in my understanding, had become such secessionist ideas in and of themselves that they were thinking out every day, maintaining their autonomy, that all of these political maneuverings were happening in a different world, a world that had already collapsed. The storm had kind of come through, blown all this shit away, and they were just sorting through the wreckage, whilst these people, the multitude, the people who they were still imposing their insurrectionary will, would just continue in their day-to-day lives. And that was inspiring, obviously, to see that this codification of democracy, even with the millions and millions of dollars, to the point of billions of dollars probably totally, could still not co-opt these people. And I think, and talking to people there and kind of reflecting on things here, probably what assisted that the most, or you know, the real difference between here and there, was that again, power materialized itself in these institutions in Cairo and Egypt and Tunisia, where these totalitarian governments were able just to kind of pour command into these structures and govern from there through laws, through, you know, brutality, through these kind of mafioso extortion. But if these institutions were demolished, there was no place for power to function. So when they literally burnt down 198 cop shops in northern Egypt, there was nowhere for the cops to exist anymore. The cops had to dissolve back into wherever the fuck they came from, back to their homes, back to the middle class neighborhoods. And when they popped out, like in Alexandria, which is where I go to next, they were literally strung up from the fucking lampposts, beaten near to death, pictures, trophy pictures taken, and ridiculed. And it wasn't like there was not very many cops, it was like there was no fucking pigs anywhere at all. Yet things were functioning, things were fine. Cairo, that was supposed to be kind of like a violent place, or as a tourist, you know, you should be worried. There was obviously a sense of, not directed towards me, but you could see it, of camaraderie, of food being redistributed, of these kind of exchanges happening, of mutual aid. And, you know, in our readings and our understandings, of course, these type of lifestyles have existed almost eternally in these places. The state imposing itself, or in this case after the revolution, trying to institutionalize the crisis, have existed only for 30, 40 years. That it hasn't been able to implement itself in the forms of life that these people are. And if it did, these people just shook it off and were able to recommunize or readapt themselves to these very distinctive and unique and peculiar forms of mutual aid that you could see materialize themselves differently in each neighborhood. So not to say that there's some type of like totalizing kind of new post-revolutionary life that was happening, but people were making it up as they went. So I spent a little bit of time in Cairo. I guess one more thing I'll say about Cairo that was beautiful was I went to the Museum of Cairo, which is like the most famous museum in the world, which is also positioned right beside Tahrir Square, which itself is positioned beside the NDP building, the NDP being the totalitarian government that's been in control there. So they had the biggest building in this metropolis. It was like fucking downtown Vancouver combined, just like this fucking monstrosity of a building that just got obliterated, like torched to the fucking ground in the first night of the rupture. Not to say it was torched to the ground, but every window's gone. It's just fucking black. It had like 100,000 offices inside, each one that was torched. So you kind of like amongst the noon heat, you'd get these wafts of fucking poison that was still in the air from, you know, 100,000 stationaries being incinerated and their desks and their chairs and all that. But anywhere you looked in Cairo, you would just see the burnt out husk of the state, which essentially put all of its bureaucrats, all of its officials within these two couple buildings that were fucking demolished. So beside it was the museum. And I guess figuring, you know, there's more than one way to destroy museum culture. You could set fire to the building beside it. The museum, a lot of it on the half, had gotten charred, had gotten pretty fucked up. But night after night, people were going in and looting this priceless fucking junk. And which is kind of like obvious that people would do it. But what was more inspiring to me was that people were destroying a lot of this shit. And, you know, you could definitely sense this kind of primitive revolt in these Egyptians going in and seeing these decorations of, like, decadency over, like, a millennium and just demolishing it, knowing that you could steal it, maybe sell it on the black market, but in primitive revolt, destroying these type of symbolisms.
Okay, I heard a different narrative about that consistently, which was that it was the police initially who were looting, and that actually a lot of people in Israeli governments to stop the police from looting. Both as a combination of agitating, trying to make the insurrection look shitty, but also out of a sense of sort of not quite nationalism, but a sense of ownership, self-ownership of that as property. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, like, where your narrative comes from.
Well, talking to the guys who worked there, for one, and also just to see the extent of shit that got demolished and stolen. No doubt there's provocateurs functioning, and also people coming out and defending these institutions, like museums and libraries, like in Alexandria as well, where they got attacked by provocateurs. People went and ringed themselves around it. But out front of the museum, and this is maybe where I can kind of hold firm to my own notions, is that they had all these kind of more junky type of relics that weren't good enough to make themselves into the museum, and they had been chiseled. There was anarchist, and I got some pictures, anarchist fucking A's chiseled all over them, January 25th, like carved into their foreheads, eggs pelted, fire set here and there, where I think the police and provocateur intervention was much more violent, much more systematic. This was kind of happening like night after night, and also leaving this graffiti or this communication of destruction that I don't think the police would have been able to mimic. And it was this type of communication of destruction that couldn't be codified by provocateurs, couldn't be simulated by the state to try to point blame or deflect blame elsewhere. And it was obviously this communication of destruction and violence, much more than Facebook or fucking Twitter, that spread the fucking insurrection. People were literally saying once they saw the smoke signals over there, they knew that this was happening. And that's what brought people out into the streets. And that kind of will lead me into Alexandria, where they say, these young insurgents that I talked to who refer to themselves as Franco-Arabias. I don't know if anybody's heard that term before, Franco-Arabias. It's kind of this culture that they've taken on from the Mediterranean. So Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, Greece, heavily influenced by Italy, these kind of, I think, you know, more or less anarchists are now in the state of insurrection. They've kind of affiliated or drawn, gravitated more towards insurrectionary anarchism by default. We're calling themselves Islamo, Franco-Arabians, and shared, and we're very proud of the shared type of culture, this unique kind of hip-hop that was sung in these, like, Italian, French, Egyptian, or Arabic. And we're very clear with, very clear in identifying with that. And we're also, as I came to know, very strong in the initial insurrection in Egypt. Their story, which I was able to look a little bit into, vis-a-vis Facebook, was they're like, check it out on Facebook. Everybody's like, check it out on Facebook, man. So now that I've gotten back, I've just been like going through my stupid Facebook that I hadn't touched in like a year. And friend me and you can check it all out. So these Franco-Arabias, their story was, that before Tunisia, before that rupture happened in Tunisia, in Alexandria, a month beforehand, one of their people, one of these Franco-Arabia students, was killed by the police. So on the 24th or 25th of January is the day to celebrate the fucking police in Egypt, and it's usually a big day of parades and all this type of shit. So they called an anti-police brutality demonstration on the 24th in Alexandria. So over the month, Tunisia explodes, things are getting pretty fucking intense amongst the cops and the Franco-Arabians and the others in Alexandria. There's street fights, there's skirmishes, all leading up to the 24th. So when the 24th happens, everybody pours out in the streets, or, you know, the youth empty out of the colleges, out of the high schools. They take to the streets and right away resort to armed struggle. They've armed themselves, they have guns, they have firing barricades, they've killed a couple cops, the cops have killed a few of them, but they've cleared the police out of central Alexandria. The next day in Cairo, as was planned by themselves there, the day of whatever the fuck they had called, everybody pours out in Cairo. People seeing this in Alexandria see that maybe this is starting to generalize itself across Egypt, now pour out by the millions inside Alexandria, taking total control of the city, rejecting the police pretty quickly, a lot quicker than it was able to happen in Cairo, from my understanding, controlling supply lines, bringing in food, occupying, like, there were still barracks when I showed up, kind of showing where people are still sleeping and this and that, but were able to take control of Alexandria following this anti-police day demo, that was called. So taking initiative of the spontaneous ruptures, kind of joining those things, or joining the enthusiasm or the communication of destruction or whatever, and being able to impose their insurrectionary desires on this much larger situation that was happening. So that was pretty fascinating to me, having been to a few kind of dismal anti-police day demos and this type of stuff, seeing that the potentiality still exists in every moment, that we can't determine what it's going to be based upon the posters or the turnout, but situations beyond our own organizational capacity could lead to these monumentous insurrections. So they're pretty pleased with themselves in Alexandria about this and wanted to take most of the credit for what was happening, which I just gave to them. They went on to say, like, how they had a funny way of saying it. Everything got fired. So the cop shop was fired. The law courts was fired, shaking me around, showing me all these things that were fired. And I was like, well, it's funny because, you know, when we say fired, it's like, you know, you're out of a job. And they're like, yep. It also means setting fire to it. That's fucking cool. Fire your boss, yo. I could get into that shit. So, hung out in Alexandria, blah, blah, blah. Came back then to Egypt. And I guess we're all trying to close this off so I don't just keep fucking jabbering, was this real notion of a state of emergency that existed much more precisely and intensely in Egypt than this kind of generalized insurrectionary euphoria of Tunisia. In Egypt, it was much different because of the Islamofascism, this growing popularization of the Islamists. The Islamists being very well organized, that they had territory from their mosques, that they had resources, all of these types of things that they were able to impose upon the kind of general popular counterpower. And I guess this phenomenon isn't anything new. You can look at Iran and all these other cases where they're able to hijack the revolution. But people were very conscious of it. When I was in Tunis, I went to this group called Women's Hands. It translates into something else, but in their own mission statement, they call themselves autonomous, mutual aid, all these type of things. And there's kind of a network of committees across Tunisia where women kind of hang out and do shit. I didn't really get all that. But they were saying that they didn't really need to fear the Islamofascism there because they'd never really had it. Islamicism as a phenomenon hadn't really entrenched itself. People were Muslim, Arabic, a lot of different things, a lot of Christians and Jews in Tunisia. Whereas in Egypt, because of its growing popularity or because it had already been so kind of grounded and organized, the military and provocateurs and fascists in general, that was kind of the Achilles heel of the revolution that they were going to exploit. So more than just the notion, this became grotesquely clear when I went to what's known as Garbage City. If anybody's familiar with Garbage City, it's kind of a popular place. Nope. No? It was weird that Dogwood Center played a documentary like the day before I left. The Garbage City people. So Garbage City, it's quite popular because Napoleon spoke about it, but otherwise known for being the world's most resourceful center of recycling and dealing with garbage. For over 100 years, these people, so Garbage City is like a shatter zone where all of these refugees from the south fled to Cairo. The state at the time said, yeah, you guys can inhabit the dump. Go there and fucking die. We don't want anything to do with you. So they go to the dump. They start, like, dealing with the garbage, making shit, realizing that they could go door to door and collect the garbage and make a little bit of money. So going door to door for the last 100 years, they've collected all of the garbage of one of the world's largest fucking slum cities and took it back to this kind of network of villages and have sorted through it over time. You know, the system's now become pretty elaborate. Sort through it family by family, recycle a lot of it, and then what they can't recycle is fed to the pigs that they had. So it became known throughout the world to people who give a shit about recycling and, you know, survival and the whole omnicide of the planet, said, here's a great example of what we can do with the fucking debris of civilization. We can follow this kind of very communal mutual aid format that these people have been using for 100 years. So the state, a couple of years ago, in rising tensions between the Christians, because these garbage city people are Christians, they decide to privatize garbage collection and bring in groups from the European Union who are now going to collect the garbage and recycle it. Of course, they do a fucking shitty job. They then say they're going to kill all the pigs because of the swine flu, although they didn't kill all the chickens and stuff like that. So they annihilate all of the pigs. Yeah, pretty harsh shit because this was people's life for like the last 100 years. And as opposed to blaming like neoliberalism, they were saying this is a direct attack against us for being who the fuck we are and also for being Christians. So there's this raising tension now of Christians and Muslims, but through this kind of like complex back and forth of blood vengeances, things have been kind of equal. There's been this equilibrium of violence. It's been kind of like working itself out until I got there, or a week and a half before I got there. So I showed up, and there had just been a fucking slaughter of a bunch of these Christians. 22 men were killed. They said, like 100 women or so raped, like kids beaten, churches destroyed, all this crazy shit. They're walking. So I showed up, and they thought I was like part of like the UN envoy or some shit like that. They're just like, white guy, tell him everything. And I had this guy who was from there who I hired to be my translator and shit. And so people were just like coming and showing like their bullet holes. And everybody kept saying that people get shot in their brains and in their hearts. Everybody's story of somebody who died was shot in their brains and their hearts. And this kind of systematic raping of the women. And so, I won't get into how this came about. I write it in my zine thing so you can look into it. But it went, the action or the event or the situation, this counter-revolutionary fascistic intervention was being exploited by the military to the point where the military didn't even have to disguise themselves anymore as provocateurs. They were able to come in full camouflage with these Islamo-fascists while they're destroying the churches. People are showing me like where the military is shooting down from, the sabotage of the sewer systems, so now all the water's backed up, everybody's getting sick, all of this horrible shit. But at the same time, people are showing me this apparatus of recycling and mutual aid and the fucking the nursing homes, the hospitals, the child care, things being recycled into art, into shoes, into food, into like everything. And you just kind of get this sense of like shit's going to go fucking one way or the other. You know, as simply put, it's going to be this like fucking fascism or this type of egalitarianism. And so asking these people, like, you know, what about the revolution, you know, that's happening? And they're like, yeah, we were there, we were in Tahrir Square, but it's all in God's hands now. You know, they're so isolated and so devoided from these kind of centers of mass populations where there's people who can surround them and just kind of left in and of themselves. So
they're
like the suburbs of Cairo. But not that I'm trying to say that's an excuse. You could see that they have been considered for all this time, for lack of a better term, like as the lumpen proletarian, as this kind of like precarious group of slum dwellers that aren't in the best interests of the revolution to protect and to, you know, fucking do whatever it is that they can do to defeat this rising Islamofascism, which is just growing parasitically from the spectacle of democracy. So long as all this money is being poured into this democratic institutions, it gives these scumbags, who are much more articulated through their mechanisms of propaganda and shit, to impose themselves and to fan these flames of fascism. I really didn't want to end my talk with that. But, you know, it's kind of like, I don't want to say it was a downer. There's also kind of like, you know, the positive shit about recycling, I guess. But
that during the revolutionary period?
Right after. So like kind of like, well, while, right? And that was the other thing. It was like the biggest myth that got busted for me was just like there was no real cease, and we people in this room kind of sense that there's no real cease to the insurrection, that things just kind of like continued in waves, that things would intensify or diffuse and disperse and all this type of stuff. And once the state was able to, you know, regroup here or there symbolically, pretty instantly they're attacked, like by firebombs and by like arms and barricades and like mass demonstrations. So this kind of notion of the smashing of the state, which definitely exists, there's still that whole kind of dialectical thing of it's withering away. Like what happens to a smashed state when empire can intervene? You know, as far as empire being, you know, a revolution for the sake of state, you know, maybe that's what empire means over there. When empire is able to intervene and set up through integrated spectacle this type of democratic fucking bullshit, which codifies people's insurrectionary desires, also desires that people feel that they want to express through popular democracy, what the fuck can we do about that here? If that really is the crux, which I was able to kind of come away with, is how can we destroy, detonate the type of imperial support that is being sent over there to simulate the same parliamentary systems, the same type of apparatuses that we have here, and impose on this revolutionary society there? You know what I mean?
I have a question about the cops. At some point you were saying that, you know, like, and when all this happened and the cops, like, some of them got killed and some of them went back wherever they came from, right? So I'm really curious about, like, you know, which social class the cops came from, because I don't know here, but it's like in Latin America, like, cops are also from the very lowest class, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I always had, like, that curiosity of question of, well, what happens when, if the lower class really raises up, what happened with the cops, which are lower class, working for lower class, right? So what happened there?
Well, that's a good one, and that really draws the difference between the military and the police, which is something that I didn't really get, was that the police are the most well-paid bureaucrats in Egypt and Tunisia, whereas the military get fucking shit. So both countries are very different. So in Tunisia, they put all of their money into a police force. The military was just kind of like this machine that would integrate the youth and kind of codify them in authoritarian kind of jargon and salutes and all that, and then just let them go after their 2 years of service. But the police were always maintained as a massive, massive, massive force, the only real force. And even with the police there, of what I understand, there wasn't that much of a hierarchy amongst them, as in different services of the police or different institutions of the police. The police were just kind of the police. Their prisons that they had, and there's an interesting report from the Human Rights Watch that you can get at the library. They talk about the prison situation in Tunisia as being extremely unique in that it's just a massive apparatus, which when people fled from the prison, they were fleeing this apparatus, that once you're released, you have constant surveillance. You have this zone that of like 2 miles that you can't get out of. You have to show up every day. There's just this life of bureaucracy which is imposed entirely upon you, and then the kind of police that surround that. In Egypt, the military is one of the most highly funded militaries in the world by the states. Like, I believe it's Israel, and then Colombia, and then Egypt that receives the most American military fucking aid. So that says something about how much fucking hardware was appropriated throughout the south of Egypt. They wouldn't release any information, but while it was happening, there's a lot of reports, and you can see in this timeline, of barracks after barracks, military post after military post being destroyed and everything inside being seized by these nomadic communities. So it wasn't like they were just like taking a couple rifles or like AKs. They were stealing some like pretty sophisticated fucking hardware, which I doubt they're going to trade in for the opportunity to vote in some warlord in fucking Cairo that's like 6,000 fucking miles away. So you've got these secessionist communities that have always been in motion who are now fucking like some of the most well-armed fucking people on earth who are going to be the targets of empire or whatever type of imperial intervention and trying to bring them back into the fold. And it seems fucking impossible that any of these people will be brought back into the fold as armed or as distant as they are now. So there in Cairo, when I was taking a cab from one place to the other, they showed a neighborhood that was all cops. like all the cops live here. And there's a lot like a lot of like offices and stuff there. So I don't know if that was for like bureaucratic reasons or for safety or just because they're a bunch of fucking assholes who all want to live together. But they seem very distinct, not just from the military, but from society itself. So when they were attacked and when all their offices were destroyed and smashed, I guess they would just not, like you point out, drift back into the ether, but would probably just have to fucking hide or reformulate themselves into fascists, Islamofascists, provocateurs, or just bide their fucking time for the military to reassert itself and then bring them back into their power networks. So yeah, real distinction, not from the lower class. You had to be like university educated. University isn't free there. Not all of them, but people were saying like they recruit from the universities and stuff. It was like the highest paying job that you could hope to get. And it seems like a lot of nepotism. And like you heard in the interview, the state can be considered like the best probably analogy of the state anywhere, but definitely there is just, it's mafioso. It's just the mafia. So I don't think just like any Joe Schmo from the slums could walk in and be a cop. You'd probably have to have this influence and nepotism and kind of be let in, I imagine, but definitely a clear rift to the point where they're saying there and elsewhere that when you'd capture these assassins or provocateurs or cops, you would hand them into the military. And you can see tons of footage of the military like grabbing the fucking pigs by the scruff of their necks and putting them in the tanks. Not because they so willingly desire, but that's now the balance of power. The balance of power has shifted. The military is trying to manipulate the situation to the point that they've actually sided with the multitude in interning the fucking police. And I can't imagine anything much more symbolic than that, as far as the relationship between military and police.
Is that localization of the police in a certain neighborhood, whatever, is that an indicative of a social class, like a power class?
I think of a power class because it's also right beside all the Air Force people. Everybody who was in the Air Force lived in this neighborhood. So I imagine had I kept going in this cab, maybe like all the fucking firemen or something, but no, maybe not the firemen, but they all seem to have taken over these new suburbs because there's no real new creation of housing in Cairo. Like Cairo is one of the biggest slum cities in the world. So probably to afford a house, it's not so much financial, it's probably political influence. So they probably keep all of that over the fuck there, whilst the rest just kind of grows into a mega slum, which is definitely what Cairo was, like just a heaping fucking just trash with sprinkles of revolutionary garbage, which is the same term that they used in Tunisia and Egypt. Was, oh, revolutionary garbage, this and that. And it was like not just the buildings that had been torched, but all the barricades and just like every, like just imagine like a summit that doesn't end. So it's just like every window is like smashed. Like I can't stress that enough. Like the smashing of the state is kind of like a literal description. It's like it is smashed the fuck out. And people themselves have kind of like cleared the wreckage so that they can move their fucking cars and mules through because the barricades are just everywhere. In the interview there, it's kind of hard to hear. I wish I had a better tape player. But they're saying how they would circle the cops. When the cops wouldn't come to them, they would go to the cops. And what they did in that town was there's the cop shop. So they circled it all in garbage and wreckage and debris and then set it all on fire to smoke the cops out and then beat the shit out of the cops and handed them over to the military or killed them. A lot of cops were killed.
Like what I've gotten from trying to pay attention to here is a lot of, well, this revolution just came out of nowhere. And I'm interested to know with the folks that you talked to how much there was a sense of previous organizing and, you know, like how much had gone in and if that narrative about, oh, look, this just magically happened, how much of that was echoed with the folks that you talked to?
I think there was like a pretty clear consensus that it was spontaneous. And that was the most, you know, beautiful thing of my experience there, was to be able to absorb that, was that in this lack of like civil society as it materializes through institutions or kind of like charitable organizations, people have just been left in a direct confrontation with the state and took the first advantage that they had. There hadn't really been any like demonstrations in Tunisia or in Cairo or these places that just didn't exist. And once it happened, it was just like everybody fucking got on. And because, you know, maybe in the lack of these civil institutions or the lack of activism, there was no real hesitation as far as deliberating pacifism. Like, the one thing that really sticks out is how violent and ruthless these insurrections were. Like, right off the bat, they went to burning the institutions, each and every institution, looting the homes of anybody they knew who was in power, their cars. Like, obviously, they were conscious of these targets beforehand, which is kind of cool, like, to know which cars are owned by who. Like, the president brought in these special BMWs and special some other car factory, and this bank was owned by fuckhead this. So those places were the first to be destroyed. But there was no, you know, real attempt of imposing any political will on these ruptures, because there was no political will that existed, not just had the influence. Like, there was the Muslim Brotherhood and shit, but they were already part of the government. They were part of the state institution. These were people who were like street vendors, or who were, you know, collected fucking garbage for the last 100 years. And they obviously led. They led the riots. The riots turned to insurrections. And then the multitude, kind of seeing that they have this opportunity to join this territory, which is now held, came out by the fucking millions. And then just engulfed power through this, you know, this balance of power, if you will. They just tipped the balance. And there was nothing that the military could do except for say, okay, well, we see which way the wind's blowing. We're going to try to manipulate this through more imperial means. So yes, very spontaneous. And but that's why I wanted to point out the anti-cop rally, but also being able to take advantage. Like, there's obviously groups or communes or forms of people who knew what the fuck they wanted, and as soon as they saw the opportunity, like, they did not hesitate.
How much correspondence was there between the Franco era?
Franco-Arabias
and Greeks.
Yeah, that's something that since I've come back that I've tried to find more, and I just find hip-hop groups. And their shit sounds pretty cool. I don't understand a word of it, but... So they seem pretty into it. Like, as we're walking around, they're like, oh, there's... That guy's Franco-Arabia, she's Franco-Arabia. And they had things like smoking hash. Like, that was a big thing. And they're all about that now for, like, the potheads who want revolution. Like, people are just walking around, like, toking up everywhere, just being like, ha, 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 like... getting into smoking up weed or hash there wherever they could. Because a big thing was, like, you would go to prison for, like, fucking 3 years or indefinite periods of time for hash. So now that there's, you know, no law or governmentality, people are just smoking up. And the Franco-Arabias are taking a lot of advantage of that.
And that was primarily in Alexandria?
That's where I talked to them, but yeah.
Did this seem to be other places, or was this kind of like a local sort of subculture?
For Egypt, it seems Alexandria.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a big thing in Greece, so it's when our friends come next week, it'll be a good question to ask them.
You were mentioning that all these foreign resources are being poured into the Libyan insurgency, like the free plane ride and everything. Mm. That seems pretty weird to me, because at first they were supposed to be against all forms of foreign intervention, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that they came to accept like this?
Yeah, that's just me totally speculating, but what I base that on is the next day, I guess, is when NATO officially said, like, here we fucking go. So it seems kind of weird that these, like, obvious, you know, nomads and peasants and poor fucks were able to afford a pretty pricey flight there to there. Maybe not. Like, I also, people, it's funny in Tunisia, people are like, fuck the Libyans. They got so much money, like, gas there, it's for free. Gaddafi just pours money on them, blah, blah, blah. So there's, like, kind of, like, a weird shit there. But were they much stronger, like, Egyptians? Like, yeah, Palestinians, that was the other, like, just the support for the Palestinians for what was happening in Bahrain. That was pretty big while I was there. There was rallies constantly being held in solidarity. A lot of, like, so in Egypt, just like in Tunisia, almost each and every prison was demolished, you know, fire to the prisons, literally. And there was one prison outside of Cairo where the fucking state, for whatever reasons, I guess they thought they were pretty firmly in control, put all the Palestinian political prisoners in this one wing of the one prison. So shit goes down, all these guys, including some dudes from Islamic Jihad, show up and just, like, demolish the fucking prison. There's a video on Al Jazeera where it shows, like, they didn't go through the gates, they just, like, tore down the walls, freed everybody, had all these buses out front, put them in this convoy of buses, took them back to the tunnels of Gaza, because, of course, the tunnels of Gaza are from Egypt into, you know, occupied Palestine. So there's a lot of connections that have happened over the decades there. Poured everybody back into Gaza, and then this video, it's got all these like freed prisoners sitting there with their guns and all wrapped up, and they're like, our lives have been given back to us, and we dedicate those lives to the destruction of Israel. They're like, cool. So that's a pretty big thing. And in Tunisia, so in talking to people, they would say criminals.
Oh, sorry.
1,000.
In that wing.
That prison was a political prisoners in that wing were 1,000. How many actually went back to Palestine? I don't know. This is what I was going to say. Each and every prison had these political wings, which is what they're doing more and more in like Europe and stuff like that, was where they try to like separate and isolate and this and that type of shit. So you can imagine in these political ruptures within the prisons, these politicos being freed and obviously kind of like leading these things or whatever. But in Tunisia, what I know in Tunisia, I'm not sure what they've tried to do in Egypt except for just like hunt these people down, is that the state has offered, and I say that was Al Jazeera, I didn't talk to anybody from the prison, but Al Jazeera said 1,000. In Tunisia, they're like, okay, trying to stay safe, anybody who is sentenced to less than a year, that's fine, you know, you're free. Anybody over a year, you can come back and we'll cut your sentence in half or a quarter or something like that. Nobody's come back. Like, not like one person. But in that video with the people who went to Gaza, it was funny because it showed like all these dudes who remained who were obviously from the PC wing. They're like, no, we'll just wait it out here. Oh, we'll hope the state comes back into power any day now. Like, I'm not going to go out there. Like these idiots, like literally just kind of like loitering around this like demolished prison with these like ridiculous screws. Like, this is just this will pass.
So they're kind of the prisoners now.
Yeah, the prisoners like across the universe there are just free.
And No, the prisoners aren't leaving.
Oh, some of these, yeah. The screws remain because they probably think they're going to get paid, but yeah. These guys, I was joking, saying they're probably part of like some type of equivalent of protective custody. Maybe, or just, yeah, citizens. Yeah, I deserved it. And so if you didn't get it, I've got a timeline of shit that I put together, but I've also got a larger zine and bloggy thing that I was going to put pictures and links and all that type of stuff to make up for my lack of multimedia presentation or euphoria that I initially felt when I came back. Now it's kind of like the grind kind of sets in. It's like, yeah, that happened. That was crazy shit. Whatever. I still got to work fucking 5 to 12. That sucks. But,
Maybe more specifically, well, I guess for you, this is or Egypt. Remind loosely Facebook and Twitter and whatever that shit is, were trumpeted as like the way that people are communicating, but also obviously cell phones disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, access disappeared for a large part of the revolution. So I'm curious, what other forms of communication people use?
Fire, I think, is probably the biggest one. Fire. I think.
But did you see? I mean, was it print matter? Was there?
Yeah. No, there was. But so for me, it was kind of like after the fact that people were maintaining this kind of like propaganda and continuing the discussion. But also, not to keep referencing Al Jazeera, but they've just came out with like the 7-hour thing about Egypt. So there was like people would like at 12 at Tahrir Square, you come. So it wasn't so much that people would stay there, although, you know, tens of thousands up to the point where 100,000 stayed, but people were kind of like coming in and out. People knew these as like sites of insurrection where these situations were taking place. And that's what was pretty fascinating about deciphering the various sites. Like, you weren't here earlier in the talk, but in Tunisia or in Tunis, there was various sites besides the government boulevard, which were usually colonial complexes. They built these huge fucking things and established their institutions so that the French powers could like parade through and look all hoity-toity and just control that part of the fucking, of the colonial city. But various sites of these situations were appearing and dispersing and coming into communication with each other. But Tahrir Square, I think, is pretty exceptional.
Were social spaces opening up in neighborhoods?
Now they were. Like, I went to an art show, this beautiful art show that was called, like, Popular Art, and it was just, like, in a mechanic's garage. And it was just, like, they had, like, I think it was, like, I don't know, like, 50, 150-something artists who just, like, put up all their shit, like, of the revolution. So you could see this new kind of counterpower imposing itself both aesthetically through the scrawl and revolutionary garbage and through these art shows, but people just, like, reclaiming territory. And when you go into these neighborhoods, some more vigorous than others that were adamant about there being no government, no cops, there's also, like, Palestinian flags hanging everywhere, like, celebrations constantly happening, protests, and there's, like, these open assemblies perpetually being held. Like, throughout the night, throughout the day, like, without cease, these assemblies were being conducted. That would get bigger when there's, like, smaller ruptures that would happen, but there's always a presence, and you could see that that was quite conscious. Within the, you know, the larger context of this conscious insurrection was always maintaining people within these various sites so that people can gather here or know that this is safe or know that, you know, politically we can operate as a different form of life than maybe over there.
Do you think there was a philosophical or ideological foundation on some level, like texts that people have been reading, or like literally text or some other kind of text that people are interpreting?
What I saw text-wise was just more like denunciations of the state that they just smashed.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the first time they were able to say, like, that guy was a fucker. And it was like, you'd see all these new books, like people lining up at bookshops before they opened. Like every day when I was in Tunis, there was like a lineup at the bookstore because books were being published so fast. Not like the kind of monopoly on books that we have here. Books are just like being published in the back. And people are lining up and it was like a picture of like Ben Ali with a horn. Like, whoa, that book looks awesome. You know, the next day it was like with a fucking horn tail. Like, oh, that one's awesome too. But they're like really into that. But there was like, and then there was like various art shows of photographs of the revolution. But I didn't see anything like, I didn't see them reading Foucault or something.
Yeah.
It was only me. I had like a big bag of that shit. I was like pigeonholing everything I saw in it. Like, yeah, totally. This is just like that. But it was interesting with all the stupid shit that my whole backpack, I had nothing but books. But the collective situationists from Buenos Aires, Argentina, they had a pretty good format looking at the ruptures that happened there. And their whole shtick, their kind of like anti-negriism, was to say that these aren't constituent ruptures, where they're trying to build these institutions that the insurrection can flow through and create these new social beings. But these are deconstituent. These are ripping down these fucking institutions so that new forms of life can be created and become outside of the state. And obviously, like in Egypt, like the one story that kept coming to me was the Exodus. Like, just thinking, like, what better analogy of fleeing the Pharaoh's army, fleeing the fucking state, not challenging it head on over insurmountable forces, but taking that kind of option of just exiting from, taking back to the desert, wandering the fuck away, while maintaining a rear guard battle against the pursuing Pharaoh's forces, but just exodus the fuck away from it. And that became pretty clear back to the primitive smashings of the artifacts in the museum. I took that as like a form of exodus, for sure. That was like very spiritual for me. It was a spiritual journey through the gallery. It's like, this is awesome. And it was just like everywhere, like, was just these big fucking Rambo dudes with like the craziest machine guns.
Did you inside the museum?
Yeah, I went
did
in.
You ransacked all
yeah, yeah, it was like, just like, it was a pretty good time to go because there's no tourists there. Yeah. And a bunch of shit stolen, because, like, who knows what that's going for. Quite a bit.